So thank you for staying. Our last speaker of the day, we're very, very pleased to have with us Dr. Angela Genge. Dr. Genge is a neurology clinician and researcher who has been working at the Montreal Neurological Institute since 1994. In 2004, Dr. Genge was appointed the director of the Neuro's Clinical Research Unit, which conducts research in the areas of MS, NeuroAIDS, ALS, and many other neuromuscular disorders. And she's going to speak to us today about palliative care in the neurological setting.
Hello, everyone. I have very few slides, so you're mostly going to be listening to me. That's because in this part of my life, most of it should be a conversation, in my humble opinion. I do palliative care by default, I should say. I have taken it in upon myself to take care of some of the most difficult diseases that people are presented with. And as a result of that, I deal with dying and living and the issues of living and dying basically on a daily basis. Part of what has happened because of my work in ALS is certainly at the neuro, I've also become one of the default people for palliative care for the non-ALS patients when things get rough and people are trying to make decisions and guiding them through their decisions. But I'm going to start with what it's like to take care of ALS patients and conditions close to that. Many of the people in this room either have seen one of my patients, take care of all of my patients, or somewhere in between. But palliative care in the neurological setting is slightly different than palliative care in cancer. It's not completely different, but it is slightly different. One of the things that I believe is that when a patient receives a diagnosis of a neurodegenerative disease, ALS being the one that brings the greatest reaction, but in fact there are a number of other diseases in this category of neurological conditions. Alzheimer's is one. There's certain Parkinson's itself and certain other conditions related to Parkinson's. And the certain other multisystem atrophies that also cause degeneration of the nervous system. As soon as the diagnosis is made, what you're saying is this patient is going to die, probably as a result of the disease that they have. In ALS, people are very aware of this because it's publicly so well known as a very short lifespan from diagnosis to death, and also because most of the early discussions about assisted suicide in Canada revolved around patients with this disease, which sort of highlighted the issue of the fact that it's a fatal, untreatable illness. However, part of the art of medicine and nursing with this group of patients is to manage life as well as prepare for death. And that is part of what all physicians and nurses do. We most of the time don't acknowledge it. When we're dealing with a diabetic, we're not thinking about the end-stage diabetes. We're just managing diabetes. Unfortunately, with neurodegenerative diseases like ALS, as soon as we have the diagnosis, we're thinking about death. Either we are or the patient is, or more likely, their partner. Because my experience has been the partner of the patient with ALS has the strongest grief reaction, and they have the most difficult time with the diagnosis, ironically. One of the tricks with neuropalliative care is the time from diagnosis to death is often unpredictable. The other thing that we deal with that is very, very different than cancer care is that we don't have the opportunity to start the conversation fighting for life, fighting for cure, fighting for remission. As soon as we start talking about these neurodegenerative diseases, we're actually talking about ways to stave off death. So we don't get the opportunity to fight the enemy. most of you receive your end-stage breast cancer patients or your lung cancer patients after they've gone through maybe a couple years, maybe much longer, fighting and winning and then having the disease come back. In ALS, you don't get that grace period. Once you get the diagnosis, you know you're going to die. You just don't know when. Very different psychological impact on the patients. And so when we first see the patients, and my team knows this better than anybody, my first few visits are talking about, well, we don't know how fast it's going to go, what we can do to slow the progression, how they can live their lives now. In some ways, I think I'm a preacher or a pastor or a life coach for the first few visits, because it's about the approach that determines how well they and the family do. If I am helping some of my colleagues with end-stage MS, they're an incredibly different population. Because with multiple sclerosis, nobody starts the conversation talking about death. Multiple sclerosis can be a very benign disease, and you never talk about death to these women who have it. But there are cases of MS that are relentlessly progressive and fatal in the same time span as ALS. Those patients have, they end up with a very different opportunity to deal with the palliative care aspect of their disease, because the initial phases of the disease, palliative care is never broached. All the other diseases are complex in and different in the way we have to manage them, but they all come with some of the issues that I'm about to bring up. I will use ALS as the example, but I think you can generalize this slightly to certain other neurodegenerative diseases that we see on a regular basis. The fastest one is something called Jacob Creutzfeldt disease or mad cow disease. That one is like a tornado. It rips through a family and a person so fast they never actually cope. And on the other end of the spectrum of neurodegenerative disease is your classic Alzheimer's disease, which eats away at a family over years before the patients reach their palliative stage. So there's a huge range, but really every neurodegenerative disease has an endpoint, and that endpoint is death, and how you manage it determines how well everyone does. So what about ALS? Well, I'm in a very odd position now, which I was not when I started my career at the Neuro. I started at the Neuro actually in 1986 for the first time. So I've been there forever. I've started working with ALS patients. Probably my first patient was 1990, so that's 20 years. When I first started, the people who saw most of the ALS patients at the Neuro actually were afraid to give the diagnosis. And the colleague who I worked the most closely with for many years never actually gave a patient a diagnosis of ALS, even though he was known in the field as a specialist in neuromuscular disease and ALS. He never actually spoke the words. It was left to someone else around him. And even if he followed the patient through the stages, I don't think he ever gave the diagnosis. So one of the things about ALS is physician fear of the disease. And I saw that in 1990. I see it today. And the fear can be within the neurologist, which makes it quite difficult. It can be within the family doc or the people who are the closest to the patient. So for ALS patients, we've become a lot more than just the people who give them the specifics about their disease. We end up taking over a lot of whole family counseling and treatment that in other conditions is handled by family docs. Having said that, we have some extraordinary colleagues in the CLSC system. I don't know if any of you are them, but we are very grateful for the people out there who have made it a part of their mission to learn about the disease and to take care of these patients. So what's happened since 1994 is I've become known as the ALS doc. The first few years, they just came to me and I gave them the diagnosis. Now we're in a situation which is very unusual, I think, in that because everyone Googles the doctor they're about to be referred to, I'm in the unusual position of everyone who's being referred to me, no matter what they're being referred to me for, are convinced that their doctor is not telling them they have ALS. So it's so everybody's in a panic. Every patient's in a panic. The good news is some of them don't have ALS, but the patients actually suspect the diagnosis before they get to me. So I have to go through the process, and I spend a lot of time with them discussing the disease. But the irony of the situation is they find out about it on the internet, because usually the scenario goes, a neurologist or a physician will say, I want you to see this really nice lady. You have to go downtown, and it goes, and she's going to tell you what you have. And then they look it up, and then someone panics, and they come to clinic. But that's the way they're finding out they're about to die. I think that's very difficult for patients. It's not something I can solve anymore, but it's like people being referred to a general surgeon and already knowing which cancer they have. It's a very difficult way to find out that you're dying, in my opinion. ALS is a disease that starts without making you sick. So part of the difficulty with ALS is they feel weak, or their speech is slurred, or their golf game is off, or they can't hold the power tool at work properly, because these are all classic descriptions I've heard recently, including the golf swing just 2 days ago, yesterday. But they don't feel sick. In cancer, people feel sick. If you have lung cancer, you're usually sick. You feel unwell, so you know something's wrong. You're not blindsided by the diagnosis. With ALS, your foot's not working. You're tripping on your toes. Your golf swing is off. You have no idea what's coming. So the initial reaction is usually, oh, she's wrong. Because how could she be right? I'm not sick. And the next reaction is, how could she be right? No one in my family has this disease. And then we start the process of figuring out what's going on. Some of this happens before I see them, but once they hit clinic, we go through this process. It's not exactly the same as Kubler-Ross's stages of dying, but there's probably a very predictable pattern that every patient goes through, and it includes some of Kubler-Ross's stages. It includes denial. It includes searching for answers. It includes anger. It includes depression. And it all happens at the very beginning in this disease when you first find out about it. It is a disease where some people would do very well and some people do very poorly, but the people in the media are usually the ones who do very poorly. So that's their only knowledge of the disease. Unfortunately, in Montreal right now, or fortunately, it's a well-known disease. So people have a mental image of what happens with this disease. What does that do to the palliative care process in this disease? Well, it does two things. One is it may do one of two things. One is complete denial. I couldn't possibly have that disease. I didn't play football. I'm not Italian, because these are two different groups. I wasn't in the army. How could I have the disease? So denial is a very powerful piece of it. The other thing that happens is people searching for the reason they got the disease. And that group of people can spend much money and many months, and they can actually essentially be near death before they let go of this need to discover why me. And it is not a simple problem, because none of these neurodegenerative diseases do we have causes except for the genetic forms. And in ALS, the genetic form is only 10% of the patients. And most of the patients are not familial. The familial patients we usually know, but most of them are not familial. So we make the diagnosis, they come in with it, or they suspect it, or I tell them. We go through a process of denial and acceptance and a lot of back and forth between the two. And then we have to get on to two very different things, and it happens with each visit. One is looking to see what we can do to slow down the disease, which we do from the beginning with our clinical trials, with our nutrition, with certain things we do for management of breathing and ventilation. And those are the three biggest things. And then the other side is, in fact, sometimes direct, but usually not, discussion about what's important to them, what determines their quality of life. And the most important lesson we have learned over the years in our clinic is that what determines quality of life changes over time. I haven't taken care of enough breast cancer or terminal breast cancer, terminal lung cancer patients to know whether this occurs with them as well. But certainly in ALS, what determines quality of life changes over time. And one of the best examples is actually Tony Proudfoot. And many of you have read his journey in the paper. But when he first came, quality of life was cycling from the West Island to downtown. And nothing less than being able to cycle that distance was going to be good enough for him. And quality of life was continuing to work, continuing to coach, continuing to be on the radio. He's a very typical example in certain respects. He did not plan to tell the world he had ALS. His plan was to keep it a secret because he's a very private person who deflected attention. And then the listeners of his radio show began calling and saying he was drunk, essentially. And so then he decided to change his approach. But quality of life for him changed dramatically over time. Over the 3.5 years I took care of him, and he's normal in ALS. So if any of you are seeing these patients through the CLSC or through other venues, remember that what they think is going to determine their quality of life in the first year may not be the same at all as what determines their quality of life in the last year. People are looking at quality of life scores in ALS. There's not a validated score. And the other really striking thing about quality of life in ALS patients is that when they first get the diagnosis, 99% of them associate quality of life with maintaining mobility, not being a burden on their partners, and maintaining independence, able to move about. As things evolve, the most important thing that comes through for what determines their quality of life is relationships. Now, relationships are very different with different people, and you can't prejudge which relationships are going to be important to the person who has the disease. And I would hazard a guess that a number of our patients, we are the relationships that matter to them, and we become part of their quality of life. There's at least one gentleman who will not come to see us any less than once a month. I think he's had the disease 4 or 5 years. We cannot get him to not come every month. Part of it is, I think, he comes to report how he's doing. He's getting worse. He's one of those slower progressors. Part of it is he comes because he prays for us, and he wants to tell us every month that he's prayed for us. And that has become part of his quality of life. If that's all we have to do to help people enjoy what life they have, we'll do it. Even when we have 25 patients in clinic, it's not a problem. But quality of life is not something that you can tell a person. You have to listen, and you have to be prepared for the fact that it changes over time. The mobility stays important in a few individuals. And because ALS, you lose your mobility, there is a small percentage where losing mobility, the drop in their quality of life is directly proportional to their loss of mobility. And those are much more predictable in their patterns and what happens. And sadly, they will sometimes do things that will hasten death despite the people around them who want them to live as they're losing mobility. And these are people that somehow get stuck on that particular aspect of the disease. It's not very often, but it does happen. And the ones that I most vividly recall over the last 20 years have all, in my opinion, have gone into that stage that truly is depression and have never been able to get out of it. They come in with a black cloud. They leave with a black cloud. They cry all the time. They are not able to get beyond the fact that this disease has happened to them. And those are the ones where mobility is critical to their deteriorating quality of life. What is more important, and I'll talk a little bit more later, but what I think is more important to understand even than the patient's quality of life is the caregiver's quality of life. Because some of the decisions that we are debating and discussing now have more to do with the caregiver's quality of life than the patient's quality of life. We regularly see couples where the patient will report actually a very positive quality of life, even if they're now paralyzed using a voice amplifier and driving their electric wheelchair. Their partner, however, has had a very significant deterioration in their quality of life. And that can occur in two different ways. That can occur because they have switched from being a partner to a caregiver. And so the relationship aspects of a marriage or a partnership have disappeared, and it's totally become one of taking care of the physical needs of the patient. The other that I've seen is a projection from the caregiver of how the patient should feel given their current physical status. And when groups have done surveys and compared patient-reported quality of life and caregiver quality of life, where the caregiver is reporting their perception of the quality of life of the patient, invariably the caregiver ranks their quality of life far worse than the patient themselves. So sometimes you'll see me send the caregiver out of the room. We'll do various maneuvers to try to determine what's really going on because of this disconnect. And now this has been reported by several groups in several countries, so it seems to be validated, and we have to be very, very careful, particularly if we're dealing with them at home, and we know how difficult physically this is on the caregiver, that we're not buying into the caregiver's perception of the patient's quality of life, but are actually figuring out how the patient is feeling. Sometimes very tricky, it's not socioeconomic. It's about people's perception. The biggest shift for caregivers is, again, mobility. So it may be why there's a disconnect. Where mobility goes down, the patient may not have a huge change in their quality of life. The caregiver's perception and the caregiver's quality of life can go down dramatically. Because once people lose mobility, you're turning them, you're lifting them, you're bathing them, you're feeding them. And in our wonderful Quebec system, most people are doing it by themselves or with family members. We have a much better system than some places, but we have very limited resources to offer patients for people and their families who are coping with this at home. What else is important? I said mobility is less important than I assumed when I got into this business. I said that mobility is important to the caregiver, more important, I think, than to the patient. There's another thing that's important, which was not intuitive to me when I started this business, but maybe it explains the reaction and why some patients really need to come to clinic, and that's hopefulness. There have been qualitative studies that have looked at the patient's hopefulness, whether they feel hopeful or not. And if a patient is hopeful, if a person with a neurodegenerative disease, this has really been done in ALS, I haven't seen it anywhere else, hopefulness seems to be a very positive component of quality of life. If people feel hopeful that there will be a drug around the corner, that if they make minor adjustments, things will go well. If they are looking forward to some particular events with hope, expecting good outcomes, they do better. And they literally do better. They eat better, they live longer, they function better, they do better long term. Another key component is usefulness. And this I really did not expect, but once this came out in a survey, I think that it gave us an insight into why certain patients did much better than others. Usefulness, the other way to look at usefulness is the ability to contribute to their social network. And what is surprising to us able-bodied is you do not need to be able-bodied to be important in your social network. Whether that social network is a family or a group of friends or a golf club or work, if the person with the disease feels that they are important and they are still contributing, they do better. And they do better at all the different things that we are managing, whether it's pain, sleep, food intake. They do better, and they see their lives as better. And it comes down to as simple as a grandmother patient, an older woman patient, who was a fitness freak, and she was absolutely beautiful. She was the love of her husband's lives. I don't know how long they were married, maybe 35, 40 years before she got sick. And it came out because she was having trouble in her aerobics class. One of her legs, she couldn't keep up with her aerobics class, and that's how she ended up coming to see me. As we saw her, she was, despite losing her mobility, and she'd be upset about that, she still would smile and laugh in clinic. And she was clearly still doing okay. And when we peeled off the layers of the onion, it was clear that part of it was that her grandchildren still came to her. Like, she still had a role in that family, whether it was giving advice or listening to stories or going to shows. That piece, that ability to contribute to the family dynamic, sustained this woman far beyond what we thought she would be able to do, which, of course, is not written in any of our textbooks, and hopefully eventually it will, but that piece is very important. And it may be one of the things that drives somebody like Tony to do what he's done. Because essentially, by all accounts, this man should have been completely depressed from the minute he got the diagnosis, should have done very poorly in terms of quality of life, and should have had the normal outcome of somebody with bulbar ALS. And yet, he did not have that outcome. He was out there and socializing and in the Grey Cup parade long after you would have expected him to do it, knowing who he was prior to the disease onset. And I think maybe in the middle of that is this ability to contribute. So everything that we can do as a clinic and as a group of healthcare professionals to enable people to keep doing their activities, whatever they are that are important to their family, we should be doing. One of my other best examples, it was I thought he was close to 300 pounds, this man. He was a huge man who got ALS. He came from a huge family. His sons were football players. Like, everyone was big. And he started becoming weak. He was very successful in his business. And he lived a good 2-3 years longer than I would have predicted when he first came to see me. He lived at home. He never went into an institution. It was taken care of extremely well by a cadre of family members and helpers. Always a big man till he died. He contributed to his family just by being there, and I think this is what sustained him. He had 9 grandchildren, all boys. And they would all come over to the house every week from various places, and they would just climb over Grandpa, because he couldn't talk, he could barely interact. But it was so much a part of that family to hug and touch and horse around that it didn't bother anybody that they would horse around at home and they'd climb all over him. And he felt very much a part of that family, even when he was basically quadriplegic and on a ventilator 24/7. So again, another person who surprised me in terms of my initial assessment of how he would cope. So this is all part of, I'm talking about living, but it's actually all part of the process of dying for these patients and how well they do in their palliative periods. There are some difficult things, and the patients who I've had them have been sort of saddened by how they do. Mostly have had dementia with their ALS. Dementia really cuts into all of the things that seem to sustain these patients otherwise. And the dementia in ALS changes their personality, which is a real problem. It affects their decision-making, changes their personality, and except for a rare exception who just was a very funny man and even demented he was funny, it really shortens their lifespan given the rest of their deficits and makes their palliative period much more difficult for the family. It affects the relationship with the caregiver, and I think that's why things go badly for these patients. So I've talked a little bit about quality of life and what sustains patients. I've talked about hopefulness and ability to contribute. The other piece of this is dignity. And in ALS, dignity can be hard to find. At some point, you have to have someone wipe your bum, feed you, wash you, move you, stretch you, turn you over. There is absolutely no physical function you can do for yourself. It's a lot different than somebody who has end-stage breast cancer whose major problem is pain, but they still can do their makeup, put on their clothes, feed themselves. ALS doesn't give you that. You lose, and every clinic visit, you have lost something else. So whatever we can do as healthcare providers to maintain dignity, I think is important. So we spend a lot of time at that. I'm not the expert. The physio, the OT, our nurse, our rest therapist, they spend a lot of time. They don't even know they're actually doing it, I don't think. But they spend a lot of time trying to make sure that whatever setup we proceed with, the patient's dignity remains intact. That includes making sure that they have whatever aids that the OT comes up with, making sure that whatever setup at home allows them to get in and out of the house, if possible, on their electric wheelchair so that people don't have to carry them out of the house fireman style. It also means involving the patients in the decisions. And sometimes that's very hard for the caregivers because the caregivers get tired, and they may want the patient to make different decisions than the patient makes. And so the dignity piece becomes a big deal. They get tired. They think, this can't possibly be good. The patient wants to die. The patient may not want to die. They may just want adjustments in their environment to allow them to have dignity. We talk a lot in clinic about feeding tubes because choking in a restaurant is highly embarrassing. And there's not much dignity. And if that's a big part of the life that you had before ALS, going out socializing, and you develop bulbar onset ALS, you lose a lot of dignity at that point when eating becomes that big. So we often approach gastrostomies early in the disease if we think that there's a major issue there. And it's for several reasons. One is we know that nutrition above anything else we do probably extends life the most. We watch their weight like hawks. We give them very hard times if they start losing weight because they're depressed. Because the research is showing that if they keep their weight on, they can extend their life and their activities for years, not just days or weeks, but maintaining weight has a huge effect on how they do. And the gastrostomy tube allows them a measure of dignity because their basic nutritions can be taken care of by the gastrostomy tube, and anything they eat by mouth can be for pleasure. And that's how we present it. It keeps them able to sit at the dinner table or be with family members, eating very little and not having to have what I would call very embarrassing situations arise. So for my residents, often they think gastrostomy tubes are the opposite of dignity, whereas I come to realize through my patient population that they can be actually very important for dignity. The equipment that the PT and OT offer are huge in this regard. Our great new chairs that sort of are like rocket launchers really help our ALS patients. There's something called an Easy Up that is a seat that you put on a chair that gives them a boost from the back. Those things, those little things, can make a huge difference because it allows them to be able to move around with whatever they have left with as little fuss as possible. Communication devices are critical. I think you guys have all seen them. They're getting better. There's still versions of light writers and computers, but they certainly make a huge difference with patients. There are certain patients that will not use a communication device. They will constantly try to talk to us. Those are probably patients who have some form of frontal dementia that where they just perseverate and don't allow us to get them involved in better communication. I mentioned about participating in activities. One of our favorite ladies from a few years ago, until she actually couldn't get her electric wheelchair into the hockey arena, went to her grandson's hockey games. She was crazy. She went several times a week to the arenas. But it was a major piece of her life, and everyone around her adapted the situation so she could get to these hockey games on the West Island. It was a huge piece of dignity for her. Traveling is another issue. We encourage patients early on to travel, but essentially patients can travel until their O2 sat sitting up drops below 90%. So there's a huge range where people can still travel. The key with traveling is that their setup is good enough that they are not dependent on strangers to do too much of what they have to do on the planes. We have become fans of cruises, not just because one of our team members goes on cruises like every second month, but because cruises allow patients a change of scene, a pleasure, and most cruise ships actually have medical services. They have staterooms that are wheelchair accessible and adapted for people in wheelchairs. And we talk a lot to our patients about these kinds of things because it makes a huge difference in their lives. And if I come up with a drug that extends their life by a year, which in ALS would be great, right now we're not even there, that year is only of benefit if they know how to use that time well. If that year is spent at home in a dark room depressed, then that drug is useless. If that year is spent going on cruises with their grandchildren, then that drug is worth every cent. So that's how I look at it. Intimacy is a little different for different couples. I think the range is huge. There are couples that remain couples even as the disease gets quite debilitating. They lose a lot of mobility. There are other couples where intimacy goes very early on. And I think it has something to do with whether they can preserve at some level the couple part while the caregiving is going on. Couples that switch to a caregiving caregiver and patient mode early, they have, I think, an effect on their intimacy. Some patients won't talk about this at all. Some patients have to tell me about it every visit. I still write Viagra for people who are paralyzed and in a wheelchair, and there are some people who I can tell this has been, just the diagnosis alone has caused a major rift, and they just don't know how to get through it. I don't have any great solutions, except that to be aware, and if you see signs that they want to talk about it or need some advice, see if what you can do to open up that piece. It is definitely one of the tragedies of a disease that requires so much physical effort on the part of the people taking care of the patient. It's certainly, there's a loss there. So I've talked about living. This is a palliative care talk, and all I've done is talk about living. What about dying? Well, they all know they're dying. What I have to tell them is, you know, I'm going to die too. Everyone here is going to die. The tragedy and the sadness is that you know, you as a patient with ALS, know how much time you approximately have left. And so you have the burden and the gift of using that time well. Somebody who gets a major stroke and dies 6 months later or before you die, you know, they didn't have that benefit. Whether you look at it as my part of what I do with some patients is try to shift their way of thinking to it being a gift as opposed to a burden. But they're still going to die. And we talk about it. Usually it's brought up first by the caregiver, in fact. Sometimes it's brought up by the patient, but usually it's brought up by the caregiver. And the key here is no matter what we do, and I state it directly and bluntly to the patients, no matter what we do, they have control of what happens to them as much as possible. So let me put this in practical terms. If a patient chooses a gastrostomy and feeds, they know before the gastrostomy goes in that the gastrostomy and the feeds continue for as long as they determine they want it. If they decide at some point they no longer want the feeds, they are allowed to stop. They have that right. If a patient chooses to use a BiPAP machine or a ventilator, before they go on the BiPAP machine or have the trachea ventilator installed, they know that when they no longer want to use it, that is their right. Because you choose an intervention doesn't mean that you have to have it for the rest of your life. And that is part of giving patients the right to refuse and accept therapy. The difference between a pill and a ventilator is the ventilator is bigger. So everyone knows when you stop using it. Whereas if it's a pill, if you stop your insulin for diabetes, nobody knows you're doing that. Whereas when it's a ventilator, everybody knows. That doesn't change the right of the patient to decide whether or not they're going to use it. In this context, of course, I'm talking about patients who are competent, who are not demented, but in fact, even the ones who start to have memory problems, we try to get some sort of strategy or plan with them as to what they would have wanted. At what point would they have no longer wanted certain interventions? Why does it matter with ALS? Because ALS has become, unfortunately, the poster child for assisted suicide or euthanasia. It is one of those things that can cause tension between myself and a couple early on in the disease. It's interesting that the tension goes away when they're actually close to the end. The tension is there early on because they want to be able to tell me that when they want to die, they want to die. And I explain to them that when they want to die, they can stop whatever therapies they're on. I can keep them comfortable. I can do those things, but I cannot kill them because I'm not legally allowed to kill them. But I am more than legally allowed to keep them comfortable at the end of life, even if what I'm doing at the end of life to keep them comfortable may hasten death. Those are the rights of myself and the rights of the patient. And I've only really run into one patient in 15 years who could not really ever accept that. And the sad thing was that in a bout of depression, he killed himself. But he had only just gotten married, so half the time he was over the moon. But he had a bout of depression, hid it from everybody, and killed himself. But that episode and other episodes have not changed what I believe to be correct. So the reason I'm so adamant about it at the beginning, and the reason we talk about it over time, it goes back to the first few things I talked about. When they're first diagnosed, they think the minute they can no longer walk, they're going to want to die. They can't cope with loss of mobility. Yet when they get to that point, they may have found a completely different reason for living. So to make a decision as to when you want to die before you reach that point may change, and I mean dramatically change. And so part of the process is talking to the person with the disease about all of these things, particularly dying with dignity. Nobody has to die without dignity, in my opinion. The tricky part of all this is the caregiver, because the caregiver may not perceive the accurate feeling that the patient has about their quality of life. And that is true for even the most sophisticated, most intelligent couples, where the partner who's well feels that the patient is suffering far more than the patient expresses to us. And so in the debate of assisted suicide or euthanasia, that becomes extremely tricky. Because then when somebody says they want assisted suicide and you've got this big discrepancy between the caregiver and the patient, you will never be 100% sure who made that decision. The other big thing about this is the caregiver's exhaustion may provoke some things that we would not agree with. And I don't think you can accurately discuss euthanasia in a setup or a system where we allow caregiver burnout to the extent that our system allows caregiver burnout. In an ideal world, when a caregiver got tired, there would be a nice place for the patient to go for a while everybody restored themselves to feeling better. We don't have that here. We have something. We have better than a lot of places do. We do have respite care. And if you're in the right part of the island or the province, you can get amazing care. But caregiver burnout directly affects decision-making in this disease. And this is a disease where the patient loses the ability to communicate effectively. So the caregiver becomes their mouthpiece. So an exhausted, overburdened caregiver becomes the mouthpiece of the patient, leading to some very tricky situations. Having said all of that, I am the first person to use medication for comfort when we're dealing with end-of-life issues. And I use a lot of medication, and I use it as early as I need to. And when a patient decides they no longer want to use their ventilator, I'm aggressive with my use of morphine and Nozanan and Versed, because there's saying you don't want to use a ventilator does not mean you want to be short of breath. It does not mean you want to suffer. It just means you no longer want to use a ventilator. So I think that that's a very fine but a very important ethical distinction. And I don't know, again, if any of you are from some of these CLSCs, but I've worked extremely well with some wonderful nurses and physicians who work in some of the CLSCs who are used to palliative care in cancer patients and are comfortable with shifting that knowledge base to our ALS patients. A couple of MS patients, but really it's our ALS patients that need this. So for the first time, really, I've started having the ability to admit some of my ALS patients to palliative care units, which means two things, that people are starting to recognize it, even though it is not a cancer, that the patient is palliative. And what it's done for the patients is it's given them a third option between acute care setting, usually an emergency room, which I cannot imagine a more undignified place to die than the Royal Vic emergency room, or at home where the caregiver may not be able to cope with essentially somebody dead in the house. So the palliative care units, I would love to plant one in every borough in Montreal, because a good palliative care unit can just change everything for this family. And it almost, in some cases, you don't have to worry about the issues of euthanasia if you know that at the end of life you're going to receive good care in a palliative care setting. It eliminates some of those issues. I think that's really, really important in this patient population. It is not spoken about in other patient populations in neurology, just because I don't think people focus on it. But in ALS, it's a huge issue, and I'm very grateful that the palliative care units have started to open up. So I don't have much more to say. I think I've talked enough. I am happy to entertain any questions, and my team is here as well. Sitting over in the corner, they can tell you what they deal with. We also have a couple from our neuro ICU who deal with palliative care and neurology in a very different way. When somebody has a devastating neurological disease, and the palliative care that I'm talking about, stretching over 3 years, is condensed into a week or two, and then everything I've just said is shortened, and all of these processes and decision-making are happening in a very compressed period of time. So if anyone wants to ask me questions, please go ahead. Thank you. If somebody may help me, it's okay.
You will be kind of encouraging more the palliative care unit or more the home care? Like,
it totally depends on the family. It doesn't actually depend on the patient, because I have had patients die who I never thought could manage at home. It depends on the family's. And it's not so much their physical resources, but their emotional resources. One of our all-time favorite patients was a little old Jewish man who I didn't think this wife was going to be able to do a thing. I thought this was a hopeless case. We were going to be placing him at Mount Sinai, no problem, because he had Alzheimer's and ALS at the same time. And he did, like, typical Alzheimer's kind of thing. He locked himself in his car at 2 o'clock in the morning, and she had to try to get him out in the middle of the summer. She was a very smart lady, but she had zero nursing experience. So I was positive we were going to place him. And it's because of her emotional support and her ability, coming from zero nursing background. She was actually probably her generation of a princess. And she took care of him till he died at home. She learned every single thing we needed to teach her. So I would have been wrong in that situation. So what I've learned from people is that it's not the patient, it's the family. And we've had the other extremes. I've had complete meltdowns with the children of patients. Meltdowns, like, 25 calls in 24 hours on my cell phone from a daughter because she couldn't deal with the fact her father was dying at home, wanted to die at home, and it was happening there. And she just lost it. It was an absolutely horrible experience for, in fact, it was the staff on 3 South ended up dealing with it partially. The patient died at home. His wife was happy that he'd granted this wish, but the daughter melted down. Absolutely. Except that, well, depends on where you live, actually. And it's ridiculous, I know, and I don't know where all you guys, but there are certain areas of the city where the CLSEs have very well-developed palliative care resources, and certainly certain areas of the city have more of the VON-style support. But you can't do it without the family. I agree with you completely. You have to have a family who's willing to go that extra mile. No other way to do it.
Hi. From the same group again. We're actually a group of nurses from the ICU at the JGH.
Okay.
And I have so much on my mind about ALS that I may have difficulty articulating my questions and my thoughts. I think we've inherited one of your patients in the ICU.
A lady. Yes.
Who I think was in denial about her diagnosis and remains in denial about her diagnosis.
Okay.
Presented to the emergency room in respiratory distress, was intubated, and will now live out her life in our ICU on a ventilator. Her and her husband are still in as much denial as ever. And I'm just wondering, how often do you see this? And do you have any sense as to where these patients end up if they're not able or open to the resources you could offer? Because it remains a challenge to us.
It's also very hard on the staff, that situation. Because all of a sudden you go through the emotions, although you're doing shift work, so you're not quite as tired, but you go through the emotions of caregivers at home because you're dealing with somebody who's just not recognizing their situation. And we have somebody at the neuro like this as well right now who was complete denial to the point where she showed up without a diagnosis in the ER and was intubated, and she's watching her tennis and reading her books, and she would have stayed in the CCU for the rest of her life, which could be years. My experience is you can't force them. You have to. These patients, when they come to the neuro, usually end up at the chest, where they just essentially wait for another medical problem to intervene. So they can be like that 4 years. And some people never ever accept that they have this disease and they're not going to get off the ventilator. The one that you have, the one that we have now, they happen to be older individuals and they will probably have another medical problem. The most tragic experience that we've seen is one that Tony and I had really early on when we set up the clinic in the current format. And he went through a wife, a family, a second wife in the course of having ALS because he was so convinced that someone would come up with a way to cure his disease that absolutely nothing else mattered. And he really, the wife that we met when he first was diagnosed, it was at one point we said, you have to get out of this. And the guilt of leaving a man and getting a separation and divorce, and he has ALS and he's dying, this woman, I don't know if she ever recovered. And yet he was brutal because everything was done to save his life because someday stem cell therapy was going to restore him to who he was. So it's part of a process. I think we managed to survive it as a team because we have pastoral care in our team. And part of the job, which is unwritten, I think, for pastoral care is to support the staff when we're faced with these. And because that situation broke everyone's heart. I think she's going to be with you or at Mount Sinai for years. And so in your case, the nursing staff will need to go process that. Because I don't think there are these individuals who absolutely never get out of denial. And they put a lot of burden on the caregivers, even if we're professionals. This guy was nasty, and I really liked, he was a very personable, very charismatic guy, but the way he dealt with his situation is very atypical for ALS patients, and he broke this woman. So it's not always fun what we do. You're welcome. Yep.
I'm also from the Jewish General Hospital.
Yeah.
And in the many years that I've worked on the palliative care unit, recently we had a patient who passed away with ALS. Was the first patient that I cared for with ALS.
Yeah.
And the one thing that I had a very hard time with was communicating with this patient. And although she did have a husband and a daughter, they weren't very present at the bedside. So I was wondering what kind of tools are out there that we can use.
We do two or three things. The thing that we try to get them used to when they can still do it is the light writer. But they have to have some mobility in their hands to use the light writer. The next step is the computer program with the dot on the glasses. What's that called, Tony? Okay. And it's this is a brilliant one because they need very little head movement. So if you can get that, even if you keep it one set at the Jewish and, you know, hide it somewhere, because they can communicate very well with you just moving their head. And then finally, we just use letter and picture boards. We use that a lot at the neuro. But it's very hard, and that's one of the things that's hard about all these decisions at the end of life with these patients. When they can't communicate, it is very hard, unless you have history with them, to know what they really want. And that history is normally not what you would have in a palliative care unit, because you're really the end of life. And sometimes they end up in hospital because the families just can't take it anymore and disappear, right? So the sad thing is when you need them the most, they're least present. Yep. We don't. We have occasionally brought people in. I think what I do is I depend on the professionals in the group. One of the things that we have, I think, that really helps us is that we have many people on the team. And every team member is really committed, and we know the patients from the beginning. So when we start seeing signals that there's a problem, if at all possible, we'll try to address both pieces of the problem. We will easily call a CLSC to find out if there's a psychologist for the spouse that's having the problem. The other thing we do quite frequently is look for respite. If we're starting to see something going on in between, we look for respite just to give everybody a break. But we don't have it's very hard to get psychologists part of these medical teams, because they're not covered, they're not employed by the healthcare system. We have depended on, it depends, our social worker has special training, our pastoral care person has special training, and the rest of us have life experience. I think that's what we have. It's really straightforward. They have to be very close to death. They have to be within 3 months of death. That's the only criteria. And that's simply because that's the rules around the palliative care units. I haven't had anyone who's gone to a palliative care unit that has hung on beyond that. But that is also because of the way we use what we can use. The experience I had with the West Island Palliative Care was fantastic. I am hoping that the Santa Cabrina Palliative Care Unit will start letting my patients in. I'd love to have a West Island Palliative Care equivalent scattered around the city in the various needs. One of the things that you guys all know is we live in a multicultural, multilingual city. And the most striking thing about our clinic is that we not only deal with the disease and the relationships, but we deal with the cultures. We deal at the Jewish. You deal with this front on all the time. There's such a diversity in our patient population that we're constantly learning new things about the way people with different backgrounds do it. We haven't had a lot of Muslim patients, but everything else we've had a lot of at the neuro. And calling someone palliative depends a lot on the cultural background.
When somebody has PEG feedings or is tricked ventilated,
yeah.
Are there, I would imagine these people still die eventually.
Oh, yeah. Well, what I tell you what we do. That's easy. That's the easiest of all. Before I will put in a trach and put somebody on a ventilator, I have a discussion. And the discussion is, I need to know, I need to have a good idea of when you will no longer want this. You can change your mind, but I need to have an idea. We have to have a plan of how you're going to tell me you no longer want it, so that we can talk realistically about what's going to happen next. It doesn't help this person in denial or my person in denial because they basically don't care. They're going to sit there and watch their tennis and read their books and have their visitors, and they have no plan. They're going to live forever. But most people don't look at it that way. Most people have they go on it for a reason. Either it's an objective reason, like some grandchild's going to be born. They have in their head a plan. It may not be well verbalized, but as long as I verbalize before that trach event happens that when they're ready, we will deal with it. So far, it's worked. It makes a big difference that I know them before they're trached and vented, though, because I have the history. And I've already told them that when it's time to come off, they will be comfortable. And I never take off a ventilator and let someone just become incredibly dyspneic. I never do that.
Is it when they come to that point where they make a decision that they no longer want to be artificially fed,
yeah,
or artificially ventilated, that's when you ask for a referral to one palliative care units?
Not necessarily. But in those patients, yes. But I would not impose that decision on the palliative care unit. A ventilator and a trach is not something that palliative care units should be dealing with. They should be dealing with relieving suffering and comfort measures, in my opinion. So once somebody makes that decision, the decision is, so how are we going to transition from a trach and ventilator to the palliative care unit? I don't think that those trachs and vents should be dealt with in the palliative care unit, because that tells me that somebody's ambivalent. If they can't give up their trach and vent, then they're ambivalent about this decision. They're not ready to make it yet. Yep.
I'm a nurse with NOVA on the West Island, home care. I would just like to say that in early December, there was a panel at McGill here, and it was broadcast on Enright's Sunday morning show on CBC.
Yeah.
It was a two-hour presentation. Many people who are involved with different aspects of palliative care spoke. It clarified, I was going through a very, a person with ALS who was also having discussions and plans about where he was going with his trach and PEG. It straightened out some things for me, and if you wanted to look at on the net, you would find it. But it, what it did, it said that the people who had these interventions, who had PEGs, who had vents, had the right to remove them.
Yes.
We as health professionals had the duty and the responsibility to provide the comfort. I had the other CLSC nurse who was involved with that client listen to it as well, and I also gave it to the nurse at the West Island Palliative at that time, and I hope that they got something from it as well. It is a very, very good debate which presents all aspects. Not everyone you would agree with, but it certainly opened all the subject matter there.
How often do you see a frontal temporal dementia patient?
ALS, you mean?
With ALS, yeah.
The statistics range from 20% to 50%, but the 50% is a very mild, we wouldn't pick it up in clinic. It's probably under 20%, and true full-blown dementia is much less than that. It's somewhere under 10%. When they talk about dementia and ALS, they're talking about this executive functioning problem that they develop, which is a huge problem in ALS, because what that means is they have difficulty making decisions. Mm-hmm. That's the form of dementia that occurs most often in ALS. It's one where they lose their ability to make decisions. And in ALS, it's all about decisions.
That's right.
So when we start to see any clue that we're going that way, we really have to hurry up some of the discussions, because they can't make the decisions by themselves. So a lot of that becomes, what are you going to want when? Those kind of discussions end up hurrying. It's very hard, the ones with full-blown frontotemporal dementia, mm-hmm. and the caregivers do not manage well with those.
Yes.
We had one guy who, it was a disaster. He had ALS and a full-blown dementia, and he was behaving very badly.
Yes, I know who that was.
It was horrible, yes. horrible experience.
Yes, I know who that was.
And I felt for the wife, because she had to go through it.
Yeah. Thank you.
So it's not common, but when it happens, it's a nightmare. Well, if that's all, would you like the podium again? Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much, Dr. Gensch, for a wonderful talk. Before you leave, I would just like to take a minute to thank you all, first of all, for coming and spending the day with us. We certainly hope that it was a good day for you. And on behalf of myself and the rest of the organizing committee, Dr. Don Allen, Dr. Golda Tradinsky, Dr. Bruno Gagnon, and Sarah Missel Johnson, along with our volunteers, Anne and Sarah, I'd like to thank you again, and I'd like to thank all of them. Please don't leave without filling in your evaluation forms. We are videotaping, so we will find you. You can either hand them in the back, you can leave them on the tables, you can do whatever you'd like. Just fill them in and leave them for us. Thank you. Have a good weekend.